The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private. Trust Ireland's leading private hospitals with locations nationwide, including Dublin, Cork and Limerick.
This is News Talk.
It's good morning to Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College Dublin. Luke, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
A number of things on our agenda, but I suppose the most startling headline is that Britain is going to run its first coronavirus vaccine trials that actually infect the volunteers deliberately with the coronavirus.
That's right, but they got permission for this. This was suggested a few months ago, as you may remember. And it's been done before, by the way, with malaria, for example, where you give someone a vaccine and then purposely infect them and see if it protects them. And they were looking for this for a few months, and there was hesitation because, you know, you're giving someone COVID-19, basically, but they've decided to go ahead with it because obviously it's a quick way to see if a vaccine is working or not. So it's actually a very good development in many ways.
Now, do we know which vaccine they're going to use? There are, as you have told us, hundreds of candidates, perhaps, between China and the United States and Europe and all the rest of it. Which one are they going to use for this human volunteer test?
Yeah, I've got a guess. I think they haven't said it's bound to be the Oxford one, though. I think the AstraZeneca vaccine, because that's the UK vaccine, isn't it? But remember, that centre in Oxford, the Jenner Institute, and Adrian Hill, remember you spoke to him. I mean, he's run these kinds of trials on malaria in the past, you see, so he knows what he's doing. I think the reason why they've got permission, Pat, is there is a kind of a treatment now, because like, obviously, if someone is given a live virus and disease develops, you've got to be able to help them, haven't you? And because there's drugs like remdesivir, baricitinib that we discussed last week, dexamethasone, in other words, it's not as if you're taking a huge risk here. Secondly, it's young people, of course, and we know that they're at low risk anyway. But it is a way to see if a vaccine's working, basically. I mean, you give one group the vaccine, you give another group a placebo or whatever, and then you'd actually infect them and see how much disease they get. So it's sort of a scientific thing in a way, I guess. Mm.
And I presume you have to load them up with the kind of viral load that they would get if they came in contact with a seriously infected person and were up close and personal, but you don't want to overdo it either.
It's a bit hit and miss. That's one of the unknowns, Pat, anyway, because exactly, if you give them too much, that might be too bad. If you give them too little, it won't recreate like infection in the wild, I guess. So they'll be picking their doses based on the monkey trials because they know how much to give monkeys to cause disease, you see, I guess. So that's one thing they can take a lead from that, I suppose. But it should go quite quickly, Pat, because you can imagine that this is an emergency situation in the world, obviously, and that kind of justifies the thing ethically to some extent as well, I guess.
Now, the question is, are these volunteers altruistic individuals or are they being paid?
They're being paid, and that's standard. Pat, anybody on a clinical trial is usually paid because obviously they're giving up their time and potentially their health, I suppose. You know, very often students volunteer for this because it's a good source of income for them. But remember, they'll be in very controlled environments. It'll be like an ICU, effectively, you know, and they'll be monitored very, very carefully. So the risk of something going wrong is extremely low, is what they're saying. And I think I'd agree with that.
Now, they're going to get something around $4,000 or whatever, but they will be holed up in Whitechapel, which, they'll be minded hand and foot as they watch how the infection develops or doesn't. I mean, if this thing is working, they'll be sitting there watching the television, eating crisps and enjoying themselves.
Yeah, it'll be easy.
Without any side effect. Maybe easy. A sore arm, but that's it.
Easy money. Would you do it, Pat? It's easy money in a sense. You're right, though. I mean, the ones who are vaccinated, hopefully a reasonable percentage will be protected and they won't have any disease, by the way. So, of course, it's the other. It'll be randomised, so you don't know which group you're going to go in. And remember, the physicians will be monitoring everything about these people. They'll learn a bit about the infection, Pat, as well, by the way, because you're actually infecting people and looking at what happens to them over time, and they'll be measuring their immune system and all kinds of things. So we're going to get some scientific knowledge out of this. But remember, I think it's because they're young, and as you know, the risk of anything going wrong for young people is very, very low. Of course, the criticism is it's not like in the wild, is it? It's not as if it's a whole load of random people being vaccinated. So that's one concern, I guess, about it. But certainly they will get useful information from it.
Ethically, it's harder, though, to do this to people who might be in some way health compromised. Or people for whom the consequences, maybe the older people for whom the consequences would be catastrophic. So I presume that's why they have to go for young people who, if they end up with the coronavirus, COVID-19 infection, they're going to come through it.
Yeah,
that's the theory.
Precisely. Now, the other vaccine trials, Pat, they are vaccinating vulnerable people and people at risk in the outside world vaccine trials, if you will. So they have to do that because we've got to make sure the vaccines work in older people. There's a risk.
But they're not infecting those people. You see, they're just taking their chances in the wild. They've been vaccinated and they're, they will come across infection like anybody else will. And the hope is that they won't get infected.
Yeah, precisely. That's exactly it. Yeah, the risk then is, you know, is different for that group. But it's important that vaccines are given to these vulnerable groups in the wild, just to make sure that's going to work in these vulnerable populations. And as I say, two of the other vaccine trials are going after, as it were, the more vulnerable older category of people.
Now, one of the worrying stats that's come out of a survey of 70,000 British adults, more than a fifth said they would refuse to get a COVID vaccine, COVID-19 vaccine. And in America, probably thanks to the carry-on of President Trump, where he seems to be forcing the pace of vaccine development and trying to cut corners in terms of approval, I think it's well over 50% now are saying, no, won't do it, won't have it.
Yeah, this is our next concern. In a way, we've got to make sure that we get the message out there that the vaccine has to be used. This has happened through history. There's been a thing called vaccine hesitancy, as we know. It's evident in people and it's understandable, especially with this pack, because people are worried, aren't they? And any mention of the virus unnerves them, you see. So it's kind of a case of public information. I mean, remember in the 50s, Pat, they used Elvis to promote the polio vaccine. He went into almost every state in America and he was vaccinated, and there was all very lots of publicity, you see, and Elvis was obviously the key celebrity. So we're going to have to do things like that, I think, once the vaccine is rolled out, we'll be vaccinating Lady Gaga or whoever the equivalent is, you see, just to encourage people to take up the vaccine.
Now, comparing the common cold to COVID-19, we have talked about this and whether or not multiple infections of the common cold in GPs, for example, would convey some sort of immunity. What do we know about common cold immunity of those particular coronaviruses?
Yeah, it's really important because remember, this SARS-CoV-2 virus is very similar to the ones that cause the common cold corona. Four of them actually in humans. One in five colds we get are caused by coronaviruses. And it's obviously a very much milder disease, but they're in the same family. But there's a huge number of similarities then between the viruses that cause a cold and the ones that cause COVID-19. So it's an important question. Can you get reinfected with the same cold virus? And anecdotally, that seemed to be the case. There was one or two studies, but now big studies just come out suggesting, you know, sadly, I guess there is evidence for reinfection with the same virus. And what they've shown is that on average, about maybe 9 to 12 months afterwards, you can pick up the same virus again and get reinfected. So there is a risk of reinfection. And then we would assume it's going to be somewhat similar with COVID-19.
So that would mean that the vaccinations, it could be once a year, could be twice a year to keep the coronavirus at bay. Moving on to the idea of having COVID-19 testing anytime, anywhere. Now, that is the holy grail, because in creches, at airports, in workplaces and so on, if you could do it cheaply, you could make sure everyone is fit and healthy or else they go home.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, this is your other front in the fight. I remember there's four fronts now running full pelt to beat this virus. There's obviously the vaccine, the therapeutic area is a second one, the social distancing and all the things we're doing is a third. The fourth is testing. And there's a massive effort, Pat, to get better tests, quick, rapid, reliable tests. Because if we can do that, that's a really great weapon to use, especially on asymptomatics, you know, because obviously if we should already have a test every day, basically. And then if you have the virus, you stay home. That's a great way to beat this virus. Remember, because now the people who have the virus on board are isolating and it doesn't spread, you see. So you've never seen, like, I mean, as we know, the effort to make a vaccine, 190 in development, there's over 1,000 therapeutics being tested. So this is like that. There's many, many tests being developed, and one looks really good, but it's called Detector. Typical name, I suppose. But it takes less than an hour, very accurate, and you can do it anywhere. So, and that's you can do airports, as you say, Pat. You can do it at home. You can do it in schools. Now, again, this is being developed as we speak. It's 70 cent per test, and that makes it very reliable. You have to buy a little device. The cost, you have to buy a little kit. It's a handheld disposable device is used. But this looks really good. They're really now saying this could be the one. It uses a technology called CRISPR. Right, so the technical term to measure the RNA in the virus, and an enzyme called Cas12. So it's a bit technical, but this looks really good. And if this is a reality, we're looking at 2-3 months from now, Pat, by the way, the testing anytime, any place, anywhere. Israel is ahead of the game here. They've really focused on this. So that may be the first country where everybody has a test, you know, every couple of days or whatever. So we're going to see these getting rolled out more and more, I think.
Yeah, because there is this attitude, and if you compare it to, say, drink driving, it's a bit crazy. I've been tested and I don't have COVID-19, therefore, yippee, But that's like saying I stopped at a guard the checkpoint and I didn't have a positive test, so I can drive on, and then I pull in and have a few pints.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
And I consider myself immune from the Gardaí for 7 days. That's not the way it works.
No, exactly. I think as you said before, the most malicious thing about this virus is this asymptomatic spread. You've got to assume you're infected when you go out and about, and don't be thinking about symptoms. Right? Just imagine you're infected, and then your behaviour should be different, right? So that's why we need to test everybody all the time. It's no point just testing the ones with symptoms, because they're important, obviously, because they've got symptoms and they're going to spread it. But maybe as many as half the spread is people without symptoms. So you got to spot those. We got to be able to measure, you know, the virus in everybody kind of all the time is going to be one solution to this.
Now, Luke, if I had a euro for every time someone has said to me, oh, I think I had it back in January, I think I had it back in February, so I'm probably okay, I'm probably immune, I'd be nearly as rich as you.
Yeah.
So,
now, that's a vicious rumor.
This is the question. So this is the question about trying to find out whether we've had it and whether we still have an immunity with an antigen test. What's this about artificial intelligence and its use in the home?
Yeah, this is another test that's being rolled out, I suppose, and it's very rapid and reliable. It's called an antigen test. And what you're measuring there is a protein in the virus. The PCR test measures the RNA, which is the genetic recipe to make a virus. The antigen test measures a protein in the virus, and it can be done very quickly, and you can use an antibody to detect the antigen. It's a bit like a pregnancy test, I guess, in a way. And this is another hope, because it's a very rapid test, I suppose, to show if you have the virus on board. It's also inclined to be more predictive if you're infectious, because the PCR test can be too sensitive, and I think we've discussed this before, and you can detect it and you mightn't be actually infectious at all. Whereas the antigen test probably is a better predictor of you being infectious, I guess. And yep, loads of antigen tests are coming out. There's one by a company called Celix, and again, it's a kind of a little strip in a tube, but what makes it really good, Pat, is you scan it into your iPhone or your Android, and that reads it for you. So in other words, it's not dependent on you trying to see if there's a band there or not, which can be a bit hit and miss, you see. So they're using AI. I mean, it's quite a laboratory to scan this device, I guess, into your phone, and then the phone reads it. So again, it's a step up on the previous test. That's much more reliable, I suppose, and says, yes, you have antigen in your system. So it's another example of a hopefully a reliable quick test. Mm.
But would I have antigen if I'd kind of recovered? That's the question.
Unlikely, yeah. Yeah, because you see, the RNA can linger. There can be remnants of the RNA can go on for weeks and weeks, and it's not actually the virus. It's just a bit of the virus, so you're not infectious. Mm. If you have antigen, it's more than likely because the virus is alive and kicking in your body because it's the protein in the virus, you see. So as I said, it's a more reliable. It could be. I mean, this is a work in progress, but they're saying this could be a better test to say someone is infectious. And maybe the case numbers might switch to antigen testing, you see, and that will give us a better measure of how many people are infectious in the population.
Now, the next topic we have is vitamin D and COVID-19. Now, you will remember Linus Pauling and vitamin C and the common cold. And I'm not sure which way it went. He was discredited and then he was credited again and then he was discredited. He's now departed from us.
Yeah.
So we have to be careful about making wonderful claims for vitamins.
The vitamin C didn't pan out, but there's no evidence that that protects against the cold. Again, back to our first topic. So that was sadly Linus, we think, got it wrong there. You know, but vitamin D is a different story, Pat, because more and more and more evidence suggesting it's a really good way to protect against COVID-19. And lots of studies now, there's at least seven, are correlating vitamin D levels with severity. So the more you have, the less severe disease. In fact, Roseanne Kenny, one of my great colleagues, I mean, she's been part of this. She's been advocating for vitamin D as a thing. And the reason why it's good, Pat, is there's a mechanistic basis. Vitamin D is really good for your immune system. It boosts your macrophages to eat the virus by a process called autophagy, which is any immunologist listening will know what that is. But it's a really good macrophage booster. And then it's also able to limit inflammation and limit damage. So in other words, there is a basis for this vitamin D activity, I suppose. And what's very important about it is older people can't make enough because they're, you know, you make it in your skin. So sunlight shines on your skin and you can make vitamin D. Older people, their skin isn't as effective as that and they're inclined to be vitamin D deficient. This may be another reason why they're at risk in a way. So the advice now is keep your vitamin D levels up. And in fact, there's talk now of doing proper supplementation of vitamin D, especially in more vulnerable groups. So the evidence around vitamin D has got much stronger.
Now, do we know how much we have to take?
Yeah, you got to
like, what's the dose?
Any normal diet will have enough, actually. You know, and then secondly, if sunlight, even 10, 15, 20 minutes of sunlight on your skin, you'll make sufficient levels for you. You know, so you don't need to go too crazy with the amounts. But as I say, in these more vulnerable groups, the typical supplements you would get in your health food shop are going to top it up. You know, but if you eat sufficient amounts of foodstuffs that are rich in vitamin D, then you should be okay. You see, so a good balanced diet and a bit of sunlight is good. This is why it's good to be out in the sun. But of course, you've got to be careful not to get sunburnt. There's a risk of, you know, skin cancer there. So we can't be recommending people get burnt, basically. You've got to be careful. So, but a little bit of sunlight every day would suffice, really, to make enough.
Now, they've actually done some work on this in Spain, and we know Spain has a particularly intractable problem with the coronavirus at the moment. What have they discovered there?
Yeah, so what's happening is little studies are being done here and there. There's a couple of huge studies being run, of course. You need lots of numbers to prove this. You know, a proper double-blind placebo-controlled trial is needed. But there was one study in Spain. It was only 50 patients, so it's a bit limited, which makes it slightly cautious. But certainly those who were given supplements had a much decreased need for intensive care if they got infected, you see. The ones who were supplemented basically had 2% risk of ending up in the ICU, whereas the ones who were deficient didn't have enough, had a 50% chance. So that's a really big difference. It seems a bit too high to me, but certainly that study is suggesting that supplementation will make you have a better course if you get infected, is the idea. So that's the one of the pieces of scientific evidence that suggests that supplementation might protect you.
Okay. Now, some of the questions coming in. Need to take my daughter for a test today. Only two public centres in or around Dublin, the Aviva and Swords. Advice is not to take public transport or taxis. I don't have a car. Home tests take up to 5 days. Unless I start walking now with my little girl, I don't know how to get there.
That's a challenge, isn't it? That's a tricky one. Yeah.
I mean, you really, what choices do you have not to take taxis or public transport? And you can't cycle from Swords or wherever to these testing centres. I mean, what can you say to people except, you know, wear a mask, get a taxi,
exactly.
Open the windows in the taxi, bring hand sanitizer with you. That's all you can do.
Exactly. That should be pretty safe. If I would recommend taking a taxi, wear the mask, make sure it's good ventilation, you know, hands, the usual thing, keep the distance in the taxi, you know, as much as you can. That's all you can do, really, because it's important to be tested in that situation, you see. So it justifies a little bit of risk there, I think, by taking a taxi.
Our listeners really try to test you, Luke. How do we know that the asymptomatics are not false positives?
Oh, that's a great question. But actually, that's the biggest concern about testing is any false positive or indeed false negative, you see. So they're very zealous at trying to look at that, I suppose, and make sure the test doesn't do that, you know, in a way. And I mean, the PCR test has a very low false positive rate. I mean, the numbers are tiny, you know, so it's something that we don't really worry about, really. As long as that's why the test has to be validated. There's no point in rolling out a test that gives you 20% false positives, is it? Because that means one in five people are told they're infected and they aren't. So it's a really important thing to keep an eye on.
Ask Luke, where are the bottlenecks in the testing system? Is it a shortage of reagent, a shortage of qualified testers, the training of testers, etc.? That's from Frank.
I think it's all of that. And in fact, at the very start, that's why we were shouting for a minister for testing, because there's many steps in the testing process. A minister could break through the roadblocks. You know, staffing was one, reagents is another, you know, logistics, all these things. It can be done, though. I mean, the shame, Pat, in some ways, is other countries had fantastic testing. Iceland, you know, South Korea, that's our goal, in a way. And we're getting there. I mean, we're not the worst in the class by any means, you see. We're not too bad. But certainly, you've got to be zealous and make sure you have an optimal testing system. It's really important.
How long after taking the vaccine will they infect the trial candidates? That's a good question from Brian.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah, I would think it'd be pretty soon. You know, it'd be like in other words, you're trying to recreate the situation in the wild, I suppose, in a way. So you'd give the vaccine and then imagine the person goes out for, you know, a day or two and then infect them. I imagine that's what they will do there.
Yeah, and I presume they can check whether the vaccine has generated those antibodies, and they say, okay, they're there, now we have a go and give them a shot of COVID or coronavirus.
And in fact, experimental immunology, we call this, because they'll vaccinate someone and begin to measure antibodies and T cells immediately, you see, and then get a time course, we call that. And the best vaccine will cause antibodies to be made very quickly. Within an hour or two, you might begin to make antibodies, you see, but it's a really good way to say how good the immune system is, you see.
Are the lower rates of people dying because we've changed our habits, or is it possible the virus isn't as deadly as it was 6 months ago?
that's another, but that's in our minds all the time. That's the good news, Pat. The death rate has gone down, usually, as we know. Now, it's partly because there's younger people getting sick and ending up in hospital, and they're more inclined to survive. So the overall death rate is calculated based on total number of people in a hospital. I guess that's one reason. But the second more promising reason is they're getting much better at handling patients because the doctors are learning. And we've had two examples. If you end up in a severe way, they give you dexamethasone, and that's saving one in five who otherwise would have died. So we've got a 20% win there already, you see. And then there's other measures, anticoagulants, the way they handle the patients in various ways are improving all the time. And remember, Pat, the goal is every week that should get better, if we're lucky, either with different treatments or new treatments come in. And by the time we get, say, 3-6 months from now, the death rate should be even lower, is the hope, you see.
We can live with the virus. We cannot exist without spare acute bed capacity. If the beds become nearly full, there will be an immediate and complete lockdown. That's probably likely if it gets to that point where our capacity is limited.
Yeah.
Everyone is saying there'll be chaos in flu season, but who's going to catch the flu when we're all washing our hands and wearing masks?
Yeah, there's
surely
evidence.
The flu rates are going to plummet. Yeah.
In Australia, Pat, the flu rate plummeted. They have their winter ahead of us, and there was almost hardly any flu because of these measures. Exactly. So the things we're doing will stave off the flu as well.
Luke, I tested negative for COVID-19 in April, but an antibody test has identified, now it looks like IgG, how long might the antibodies stay? That's from Mary.
Yeah, well, that again, it's variation. I mean, you see, what's about, clear about this, but is the immune system, kind of is in, like everything else in biology, varies between people, and some will have a sustained antibody. The Icelandic study, there was antibodies for a good, strong level for 4 months after infection, you see. Other studies suggest it begins to wane. There's no doubt antibodies will have to wane because there's no point making loads of antibodies all the time if you don't need them, you know. So there will always be a range there. But antibodies should persist for a few months, we think, in people.
Yeah, and then they're ready to go if there's another attack. That's the theory. Is it safe to go to public swimming pools? This is our last one. Does chlorine provide enough defence against COVID-19?
Well, the view of swimming is pretty safe, actually, as long as you're, again, observing the distancing rules, then it's great for your health. And, of course, a bit of exercise boosts the immune system. The fear about swimming was if you're hanging around crowds beside the swimming pool or in the changing rooms, avoid that. So get in there and have a good swim, you know. Now, obviously, if the virus comes out and ends up in the pool, it won't last long, you know, because of chlorine and also because of dilution. So there's no risk of catching the virus in the swimming pool, I don't think. So that's a pretty safe thing to do.
All right, Luke, thanks again very much for joining us. Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry in Trinity College in Dublin.